Good evening, this is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. It's nice to be back in the command seat once again after last night. And it's a great pleasure to tell you that, as ever, we try to render necessary public service. And a lot of people need their Royko fix. Mike Royko has been on vacation all this week, and the column has not appeared in the Sun-Times. But through special arrangements, here he is tonight, sitting at our table, and we're about to trade impressions of Chicago, perhaps some characterizations of some of the leading players in the Chicago political game, and to the extent that Mike Royko will sit still for it, maybe even some intrusive questions about himself. So tonight, a night with Mike Royko on Extension 720, and that will begin right after the usual update on the evening's news from Marty McNeely. And tonight, Mike Royko, great pleasure to welcome you here, sir.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate your coming in for this occasion. You've been vacationing this week.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you go on vacation?
Listen to the frogs.
Out in the country?
Yeah.
Listen, are you serious about this rib fest thing?
Sure, sure.
Are you really the best rib maker in all of Chicago? I have my doubts.
Yeah, I probably am. I'd say probably at worst I'm one of the three best rib makers in the city.
Who are the other two?
I don't know who they are.
Well, you're even counting out Leon, I gather.
Yeah, I can cook better ribs than Leon. And I don't cook as many, but I go for real quality.
Well, how did you come by this art? You made very clear in the few columns you've done on this recently that you know that it's a black art and that black ribs in Chicago are infinitely better than anything turned out by white establishments. Whatever you are, you're not a black man. Where'd you learn this stuff?
Well, I always liked ribs, and but the realities of urban life are such that if I get a taste for ribs at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night, you just can't pop into somewhere on 63rd Street any more than somebody from 63rd Street is going to pop in to a bar up on the Northwest Side. So I decided I'd have to learn how to cook my own ribs, and so I've studied them. And rib makers aren't that generous with their secrets, but if you watch what they're doing and ask a few clever questions, you can find out a few tricks. And so after years of long study, I perfected my ribs, and now I'm ready to put them up against anyone's.
Well, in one of your recent columns, you give the Royko approach, but you leave some very crucial information out, namely the sauce.
Oh, well, I wouldn't.
It's a secret sauce.
Reveal the secret of my sauce, no.
And you've invited others who think they can do better ribs than you to engage in a great contest. It will be Mike Royko's Rib Fest, to be held in Grant Park, I gather.
I'm not sure if it'll be Grant Park. We haven't decided on which park it'll be. It might be Burnham Park.
And judges will judge blind?
Yeah. I don't know how many contestants there will be. The day after I announced it, we had several hundred people call and say they wanted to be in it. So there may be thousands of people out there all with their grills cooking their ribs. It'll create a huge cloud of barbecue smoke that'll probably be visible all the way to northern Canada. And
it will contribute to the greenhouse effect. It will densify our atmosphere.
Well, I think it'll be nice, all this rib smoke being wafted over half the United States. We'll have judges judging people in groups. We can't have one huge judging, but we'll get semifinalists and then finalists, and I will go up against this finalist probably, because I'm not going to waste my time in the preliminary judging.
Well, no, not if you're a world-class rubmaker.
No, you shouldn't. Right. I've seated myself in the finals. Uh-huh. And then it'll be a blind tasting, and in all likelihood, my ribs will be judged the greatest.
Now, how are you going to avoid having this thing, especially if it's held in Grant Park, labeled and advertised as Mayor Burns' Mike Royko Rib Fest?
Well, as a matter of fact, the people who ran Chicago Fest are having some other kind of fest on Labor Day, and called. My secretary talked to them, and they wanted me to bring my rib thing into their fest, but I turned it down. It's just too big for the city to handle.
Speaking of fests, I read your piece about the critic who complained about Sinatra, and I read how you put him down. I wasn't necessarily surprised at that judgment on your part. What really surprised me was that you were there at all. I gather you were haunting Chicago Fest, at least on one or two nights, and listening to some kinds of music, if not all the music.
Yeah, I heard a lot of music at Chicago Fest. I went and listened to the stuff at the... heard Buddy Rich and some other jazz groups on the jazz stage. I listened, went over the vintage rock stage and listened to some rock over there. And heard Sinatra. And I wandered around, ate a lot of food, and listened to a lot of music. Yeah, I like Chicago Fest.
I know you a little. We've met privately as well as the one other time you were here. It somehow doesn't square with my image of you that you would be going off to Chicago Fest. I don't know why, so I guess I don't really understand you.
I don't know why. I mean, I live in the city. I can get to Chicago Fest from where I work in a matter of minutes. I like music. I like Billy Goat's beer and hamburgers.
Well, yeah, I know that you're an habitué of Billy Goat's. I guess what surprises me is that my hunch would have been that you avoid big crowds, that you're a sort of a private guy and don't like to mix it up with the multitudes.
No, matter of fact, it's the opposite. A lot of the things I enjoy doing put you in contact with large crowds. You're part of a large crowd, and if I want to go to the ball game... there's going to be a large crowd. If I want to go to a concert, there's a large crowd. I want to go to Chicago Fest, you can't avoid it.
Billy Goat's is your place rather than Ricardo's.
Well, I don't know, it's my place. It's convenient to where I work. You can get a good hamburger there and a beer, and so I go in there once in a while.
But I never see you at Ricardo's, which is where you see a lot of the newspaper people also.
I drop in there once in a while, not often. Yeah.
The serious stuff. I think, as is true for all close elections, you can find a number of people to whom you can attribute to the outcome of the election. We are now already into the mayoral election season, though it's going to be not till, what, next February that we do the primary.
Mm-hmm.
And then March, the mayoral election. If one looks back to the February in which the Democratic primary was last run, and examines that surprising victory by Jane Byrne, I think you might fairly say that she was elected by Mike Royko. It was such a close thing, and everyone expected her to lose. You did two or three very strong columns for her, or rather condemning and ridiculing, and I think properly ridiculing, some of the postures that Melendick was taking at that time. So lots of people concluded. The crucial difference was those columns by Mike Royko.
Well, I don't know if that's true or not, that that was a crucial difference. But what I did do was, I think I recognized before anyone did and before Burns people did, that the blizzard was a political thing rather than just a weather story. And I began writing about, before I think anyone did, about the way it was being handled, and about the ridiculous things that were being said and done by the city of Melendick's administration. You know, Melendick and his people contending that the everything was fine. And
they told us that they would open up all the schoolyards, we could park our cars there, but the schoolyards remained unplowed.
Things were
stuff
in chaos, and they were doing a terrible job. In the meantime, they're telling us that everything was fine. And when I wrote about that often enough, then Burns people recognized and said, hey, you know, this is our issue, and they ran with it, and then Melendick became very defensive and made that preposterous speech comparing himself with great people in history.
Well, you mean the crucifixion speech?
Yeah, sure.
It was an incredible image. He saw himself on the cross somehow.
And in the meantime, he couldn't do anything right. The commercials showed, you turn on your television set and you'd see Mrs. Melendick looking very refined and rich and comfortable on a commercial, and then you switch to the news, and there's old people falling off miniature icebergs trying to get to the grocery store. So I suppose in that I made, I kind of clarified the snowstorm as a political issue would have been my main contribution in that race.
Yeah, but
race.
Right the day after the primary election, or was it 2 days?
Well, no, two or 3 days before the primary, I did write a column, if not endorsing Burns, saying that the city has survived a lot of things, and if Burns elected, we can survive that too. That was as strong of an endorsement as I made of her, but in effect, I guess it was an endorsement.
Well, you did a post-election kind of endorsement, though.
Well, nobody ever elected anybody with a post-election column.
I know, but you know the column I'm talking about. It was a totally uncharacteristic.
Not really.
It was the one in which you suddenly put aside all of your usual scorn and all of your wonderfully and bitterly tooled irony and seemed to be saying from your heart in a bubbling over of surprised happiness that now perhaps the days of graft and boodle and corruption and incompetence were past. Chicago is finally risen and thrown off the machine. That was the implication.
Your memories of that column are hazy.
Maybe it was the reading.
I never would suggest that in Chicago the days of graft and boodle, et cetera, are over. I mean, the day I do that, throw a net over me.
Well, you congratulated the people on
what
Chicago.
What I said was that for once, and the first time in my lifetime, the voters of this city surprised everyone, including themselves, by not doing what they've always done, and that is dutifully electing the candidate of the machine, which they had been doing time after time since 1932, thereabouts. And that was the point of the column, that look what you did. You went out and voted according to your anger.
The people have risen.
Yeah. And that was what impressed me about the election. Was not that Jane Byrne was elected, but that the voters did it. She had almost nothing in the way of resources. She was up against the remnants of a very, very powerful organization. They had all the money. They had all the precinct workers, and none of it did any good because people were angry. And people just said, enough. You can't even pick up the snow, and then you tell us you've picked up the snow, and I can't get out my front door. Baloney. And so they went out and threw Blandick out. I think Blandick truly deserved to lose. He, if you can't win with the kind of resources he had, if you aren't sharp enough to recognize that when that snow started piling up, all he had to do was have a press conference saying so there are people who have fouled up. Those people are being removed from a position of responsibility. I'm firing people. We're going to put people in there who can do the job. He would have been reelected.
I think you're right. Sure.
Instead, he sat there. He had this this snow removal king who was a nightclub operator. He didn't know what was going on. Blandick didn't know what was going on. He was listening to his people tell him everything's fine, everything's Jake, and if that's the best a guy can do, he shouldn't be in office.
Well, anyway, we got Jane Byrne, and you congratulated the people of Chicago on how they acted up in that election. I've got to run to commercials in a second. I want to set you up. I am wondering what you expected from Jane Byrne, and whether your expectations have been borne out or have been disconfirmed, which is a roundabout way of asking you, what have we had during the last 3 years, and how fares the city under this administration? And I'll return to that right after these words.
And now back to Extension 720 and Milt Rosenberg.
With thanks to Doug James and directly back to Mike Royko. I don't know how you're going to take the following. You are many things. You're a man of, I think, deep moral concern. You are a brilliant writer. You are also, as I see it, sort of the embittered and ironic poet of the spirit of Chicago. You celebrate Chicago, and you take its two and with regard to Chicago politics, the two defining characteristics with which you are quite familiar and which you represent with beautiful wit are corruption and incompetence. we've had 3 years of this administration. Surely you were hoping that Chicago really might change, even though it's a great kick to celebrate its corruption and incompetence. That's wonderful material to hone your ironic style on. But how do you feel about what we've had over the last 3 years and the way the city has changed or perhaps has not changed?
Well, first of all, my thinking on what a mayor can do and what you can expect of the mayor of a city like Chicago or of Detroit or of any major industrial Midwestern or Northeastern city has changed considerably. 15 years ago, we had large sums of money being pumped into the cities by the federal government. 15 years ago, state legislatures, cities were still the primary influence in the state legislatures. Today, the federal money has all but dried up. State legislatures are now controlled by downstaters, rustics, small towners, suburbanites, all of whom are, most of whom are hostile to the city, to its residents. And so being mayor of a major city, whether it's this city, New York, whether it's Detroit, Philadelphia, is really a lousy job. The money's not there, the tax base isn't there, and at the same time, the demands are greater. People say, I want this, I want that, why can't you give us this and that? The dough just isn't there. We've got a federal government now, an administration that says, you know, we've got to build bigger and better bombs and bigger and better bombers and bigger, give the military more and more, and you're just going to have to shift for yourself out there. Well, in the meantime, they're taking our money to build all these boom-booms, which means we don't have as much money to put into our own communities. And
also in the meantime, having lowered our taxes 1 year, they raise them the next, and at the same time, they're pushing a constitutional amendment for a balanced budget.
I have no idea what they're doing out there. I mean, it's like watching one of these old shell games. when all these tax cuts, I didn't see any money, and I don't expect to see any money. They'll take more away from me, and now it's tax reform. I mean, that thing is so confusing. I don't think anybody understands what's going on.
Maybe it's time you cleaned up your act and stopped drinking and smoking, because they're going to tax both of those pleasures well, you know.
Well, so I should preface my views on Byrne by saying that I don't think anybody really do an outstanding job of governing cities like Chicago. Now, if you want to talk about Portland, Oregon, Minneapolis, cities with very small minority populations and very small welfare programs, very small. The demands for social services are very small. then you've got a different game. But cities like this, no. It's a murderous job.
Weren't you a little surprised, though, at how quickly she fell into the conventional pattern of Chicago politics? One did remember the talk about the evil cabal of that was Eddie Verdoliak and Burke and one or two others. One remembered, indeed, I heard her say, sitting at this table just about a week before the primary, that she thought corruption was a very serious problem and the old political structure was no longer workable and it had to be put aside and one had to go to kind of decent citizen-oriented politics. But in the first 3 or 4 months, she established her control over that old machine.
Well, yeah. Remember, Jane Byrne came out of the machine. Jane Byrne was not a product of any IVI reform or movement. Jane Byrne, her political teacher was Daley. Her whole political experience was within the organization. So it was unrealistic to expect her to become something that she was not. Jane Byrne comes from a background where there is a strong central figure. I mean, her church, her background is very disciplined. Church with authority figures, and you do what you're told. And so, no, I'm not surprised that Byrne looked around and said, rather than dismantle a political organization, I'll use it. That's the way most people, I think, would approach the job. As far as the evil cabal, that was kind of fun to kick her around for that. You know, the evil cabal wound up as part of the inner circle in the administration. Unfortunately, in dealing with the city council, there aren't your choice of people that you can deal with in the city council is very limited. You've got a bunch of genuine political hacks who are just it's their life's ambition has been fulfilled by becoming an alderman. And then you've got a handful of real shrewd guys who have a certain furtive look about them, like Fast Eddie Verdoliak and people like that. And while they may not be the kind of people you would trust 100%, they are the brightest people in the council. Verdoliak is a real sharp guy who can get things done and make things happen. And so, once again, you're running this big city, and the tendency is to take the easy way. This guy is smart. Remember, when Byrne first came in, a lot of the people in influence in this town, the bankers, the LaSalle Street people, they didn't like her, they didn't trust her, they thought she would throw the city up for grabs. So she looked around for, where are there people I can deal with? And
she fell in with the evil cabal that reassured the bankers.
Yeah, I think that did. bankers have never worried about what kind of cabals they deal with, as long as they can collect their money.
Hmm. I had a fascinating conversation on the air two nights ago, and it got even more fascinating when we went off the air. Three of the best TV street reporters in town, Dick Kay, Levine from ABC, and Don Harris from this station. After the program, we stood around in the hall talking for a while, and I heard some fascinating predictions about the mayoral race to come, that there's a whole field of people who are going to be jumping in. One of them, Dan Rostenkowski, is terribly interested and may really decide to come in. Another, Seymour Simon, is taking the bait that's been waved before him by Don Rose rather seriously, even though to run he's got to resign from the state Supreme Court. And a black candidate, there are a number of possibilities, not only Harold Washington. And the most incredible speculation I heard is, the dialogue went this way, what do you think Thompson will do if he loses the gubernatorial race? And I said naively, I guess he'll make a lot of money in law unless he accepts a cabinet post in the Reagan administration. What if he decided to run for mayor?
I doubt.
And I said, come on, you're kidding. But my interlocutor said, no, not necessarily. Think it over. What do you think?
No, I don't think Thompson would run for mayor. I don't think he'd want to be mayor. I had a long talk with him once before he ran for governor when he was U.S. attorney. And they were trying to talk him in, Republicans were trying to talk him into running for mayor then. And
well, then he couldn't have won. But the notion was here, if you got a split field with a few of the Democrats going at each other, and if you, with now all the extra authority of having been governor for a long time and having done rather well and responsibly with it, perhaps he would be in a much better position.
If he would want to be mayor of Chicago, I don't think he'd want to be mayor of Chicago, because Thompson has certain specific ambitions, and
probably wants
mayor,
to be president.
Yeah,
before
being
he's
mayor
50.
Of Chicago isn't going to get you very close to those ambitions. And that's the way he felt then, and I'm sure that's the way he feels now. I think if Thompson loses this election, I think what you'll see Thompson do is go into law practice, try to earn some money, and make a run for something else, something bigger than, or something that would give him a chance at a national position down the line. But no, Thompson wouldn't run for mayor. He'd probably be so exhausted, and he would look like a terrible opportunist. And that's not a good time to run for mayor. It's when you've just been defeated for the office of governor. I mean, you're not exactly on a roll.
Well, you confirm my own reactions, because I thought it was rather an odd
suggestion.
Yeah,
I think that's the kind of thing that television reporters talk about in hallways.
Let me quickly do an ID. This is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. But what about the Democratic field? I didn't even mention Richie Daley, but we know that the great fight that is supposed to be shaping up is the return of the Crown Prince.
Well, the more candidates. Now, if Rustenkowski wants to get in, and Seymour Simon wants to get in, and Harold Washington wants to get in.
Well, I was told also Bill Singer is thinking of getting in.
Yeah, he's thinking of that. If they all get in, or if some of them get in, and there's no question in my mind, Jane Byrne will be reelected. The best thing that could happen to her is to fragment all of the people who don't like her. And that's what would happen, is they'd be siphoning off votes not from her, but from, say, Richie Daley. So the anti-Byrne vote would then be scattered among three or four candidates, and she would get the most votes, and she'd be the winner. Simple as that. I mean, there's just no other way it could turn out.
Does young Daley have the style, the ability to mount a really significant challenge? I suppose the challenge is significant just by virtue of his name being Daley and his having built up some credits for himself as state's attorney, but... what's he like? Does he have the quality to make a real run out of this one?
It's hard to say. I think that if it's Byrne against Daley, then you're going to have a real, real close contest. His name is his greatest asset. Other than that, it's pretty hard to say just what Richie Daley's got. He's shy. He doesn't like, for a guy who's going to spend his life in politics, if he can, he's not at home in the kind of things you have to do in modern politics. You notice how seldom you see him in any situation that isn't controlled. I mean, you don't see Richie Daley running on panel shows and exchange. Has he ever been on this show?
We thought we had him booked. We went through the phalanx of public relations people, and there was a commitment, and a week later the commitment was withdrawn.
Yeah, sure. They sat around and talked about it and thought of all the things that you might throw at him, and he would sit there, and he would just have a hard time dealing with things that he's not programmed to deal with. He will talk about the state's attorney's office, but you're not going to get him to talk about anything else. And so nobody really knows whether or not Richie Daley is qualified, whether he's got the mental equipment, or whether he's got the executive abilities to be mayor of this city. The support for Richie Daley is a combination, I think, of hostility to Byrne, plus loyalty to the Daley name and the traditional claim that Southside politicians think they have on the office of the mayor.
When Bonnie Prince Charlie was languishing in France, the Stuart pretender, and then announced he was coming back to take over Scotland again, at least, the Scotland that his father had ruled, or was it his mother? He was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, I guess. No, I've got that all wrong. His father was James the First. I'm confusing myself, but he was
the
legitimate...
Well, I don't think he can win be mayor either, whoever this guy is you're talking about.
Well, Bonnie Prince Charlie was the legitimate pretender to the crown of Scotland, and when he announced he was coming back, all of those who were loyal to the present regime, or many of them, defected and welcomed him, and a little war was fought, and unhappily they lost a battle. But I'm doing that roundabout thing and muddling myself on historical recall because I am wondering whether we may not have something parallel shaping up in Chicago. Many of those in the evil cabal and many of the others who leagued with Jane Byrne once she had been elected and consolidated her power, might they not be very tempted to abandon her in the name of the pretender?
Some might, but there are an awful lot of them who don't like the idea of Daley getting a hold of that office, and the Bridgeport South Side crowd moving in again, because they have a way of when they have the office of saying it's ours, and you come in here with hat in hand if you want anything. And people like Eddie Verdoliak don't regret at all that Jane Byrne was elected, and Eddie Burke and others don't regret at all that Jane Byrne was elected, because it freed them. And there is a great deal more, surprising to say, there's a great deal more openness in Chicago politics. And that's the result of her being elected. They figure, well, all right, if she gets knocked off at some way where down the line, then maybe I can be mayor. Maybe my ally can be mayor. But looking ahead, they say, hey, if Daley gets back in there, none of us can plan anything for the future without going through him or his people. And so a lot of them really prefer Byrne to Daley, and a lot of them, of course, sit there looking, figuring out who's going to win, and so whose side should I jump to? They don't care who the mayor is, as long as they're on their good side. That's that lesser level of political hacks in town. But the more influential ones in the organization, the more powerful ward committeemen, are I think they prefer somebody like Janie, because that gives their future a little more flexibility.
We got to stop again. When we come back, I want to talk about a very interesting man that we haven't really discussed yet tonight, namely yourself. Some questions about the way you work, some questions about what really moves you and what really energizes you in the superb writing that you do, and maybe even some questions about your plans for future operations. We know that you've been courted by many newspapers that have tried to get you out of Chicago, and that you decided, I think quite wisely, that you are of Chicago bred, and everything you do is somehow coordinate to this rather odd urban culture of ours. But I imagine that you're at a point in life where you might have some other things in mind rather than merely the column, though merely shouldn't modify a reference to the column. It's the best thing of its sort done in American journalism. But I want to try to get through and talk with you about yourself with regard to those and related matters, and we'll do that right after these words.
And now back to Extension 720 and Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Doug James. Our guest tonight is the inestimable and unique Mike Royko, one of the great assets of the city of Chicago. And you'll have a chance to talk with Mike and put any questions to him that you desire in about 15 minutes. The number is 591-7200, 591-7200, 312. The area code if you're calling long distance. And you've got a lot of readers out in the country. How many papers syndicate you now?
Oh, in this country, about 125.
What's the one at greatest distance from us at the moment?
Probably Melbourne, Australia.
Well, if you're calling from Melbourne, Australia, the area code is 312, and then 591-7200. Really, Melbourne, Australia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get a lot of mail from Melbourne.
What do they make of you?
I don't know. I get calls sometimes from their early morning talk show guys, and they ask me to go on the air and talk. And I haven't got the faintest idea why somebody in Melbourne, Australia would want to hear me talk.
But where else outside of the country are you published?
Oh, Canada, somewhere in Mexico. I'm not sure. Somewhere in Hong Kong or one of those countries.
I'll be darned. I didn't know about that. Yeah. But even assuming that you're published in Indianapolis or in Denver or places like that, what do they do with those columns of yours that are so tightly focused upon Chicago?
Well, they don't use the ones that are tightly focused on Chicago. I don't write that many that are of interest purely to Chicagoans. I try to avoid, you know, our conversations about Chicago politics are not the type of thing I normally deal with in my column. I let the political writers handle that, who is thinking of running, who's backing this guy and that guy, all the smoke-filled room type stuff. I've never dealt with that in my column. And so three of my columns are syndicated each week of the five. And so generally, of five columns, three are can be used in other parts of the country.
You are an essayist. You may resist that, but you practice the established form of the essay within the tight limits of the number of words that fill the assigned space. And all good essayists are moralists at heart. And to be a good essayist, you need to have clarity of mind and some firm and deeply held values. But you need something else. You need great writing skill. I so much admire what you do as a writer. I also admire and I think share most of the values, which are very evident. Turning to the writing for a moment rather than to the values and to the moral convictions, do you have a lot of conscious awareness of what you do? Do you know the Greek names for the various mechanisms of irony that you use, or does it all just come intuitively?
I used to, but I've done a certain amount of reading on satire, the forms of satire. But no, it's kind of a natural thing. I don't know. I've always been able, since I was a kid, able to mess around with words in written form. And it's a funny thing, I really found the essayists, the most boring part of various English courses we had to take as kids.
You resist my labeling you an essayist?
No, I guess I am. I suppose I am, but it's crazy that I wound up doing that for a living. I don't know. I think I've always written more from instinct than with any trying to shape something in a particular style.
I've been reading you since I came to Chicago, which was 1965. It seems to me you've gone through some transformations, but I'm not sure what they are. How do you see your own writing now as compared to what you were doing 5, 10, 15 years ago?
Well, I don't use... I've kind of abandoned certain techniques, or I use them very rarely. I don't use the fictional, satirical approach nearly as often as I once did, because...
We haven't heard much of Slats Grobnik.
No, well, years. Slats, for one problem was I had written most of the Slats columns I had written. I had written at the Daily News, and so... Daily News readers were very familiar with Slats. When the news folded and I moved my column to the Sun-Times, I had an entirely new audience, as well as a large part of the old audience, and the readers would have found Slats kind of confusing. They didn't understand his background. They didn't understand why he was the way he was and what he represented. And so I kind of dropped Slats. I'd pretty much written as many Slats columns as I really wanted to. I never intended Slats to be a Mr. Dooley character or a Clemlane's Oxie O'Rourke character. I only did about 30 pure Slats columns in all the time I was in the Daily News.
I thought there was a Slats book.
There was, but... It was my last collection of columns, which came out in, I think, 73. And at that time, I had written about 25 or 30 Slats columns, and I used them all, most of them in the book. And I just didn't find any reason to bother him too much after that.
There's a new collection of your columns coming out in just a few months, I understand.
Yeah, in October. Mm-hmm. It's the first collection I've done in about 9 years. Yeah, it'll be out then.
No single column represents the nature of your work, but one recent one that I found most fascinating, and again, the irony is there, and behind the irony and the satire, there is a deeply felt and quite legitimate anger, in this case about something that I know you feel very deeply, all the mad things we do with handguns. And the one I have in mind is Gun Owner of the Year, published on August 6th. I wouldn't mind if you were so disposed for you to just read some quotes from that and kind of replay the column, not reading at all, but...
Why don't you read it? I really read sort of in a monotone and people fall asleep.
Let me show you what I so much admire. It's just another kind of workaday illustration of the style. Tell the story first. There's this guy, one of the good, a good old boy down in Florida.
Yeah.
And... he and some of his friends come over to his place, and they do some drinking, and they decide they pull out some guns.
Yeah, well, he was a sharpshooter, and They live in the Florida Panhandle, and they just love guns in the Florida Panhandle. You drive around there, and you look at signs on the country roads, and they look like Swiss cheese. That's how they amuse themselves, shooting up all the signs. And so he had some pals over for dinner and some good old boy talk. And afterwards, they drank a little beer. They went outside and show what a good sharpshooter he was. They began putting cans and bottles on top of their heads, and he was shooting off the cans and shattering the bottles. And then one of the guys put a can on his head, and he stepped back a little farther.
Decided to do a William Tell act.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And, with a can, a beer can instead of an apple.
And nobody, you know, none of us are perfect. And at that time, he aimed a little low, and that was the end of his buddy.
Well, he scored two out of three.
Yeah.
He succeeded twice. Yeah. And on the third shot, he happened to kill his friend. And here's the end of the column. Nobody is sure why McMullen missed the beer can and hit his pal in the forehead. It could have been a downdraft of wind, or maybe Mark stood on his toes, Mark being the victim. That will probably be determined at the trial. Mark's sister, Enid, 31, says, "It was just a stupid, useless way to die. It shows we need some tight gun control laws." Enid is a dreamer, of course. Gun control is about as popular in Florida as snow. Besides, as any gun lover would tell her, all this case proves is that what we really need are not stricter gun laws, but much bigger beer cans. Great.
Thank you.
You've now and again, rather often, gone to this matter of the absence of gun control laws and the continuing epidemic of accidental destruction of human beings with handguns. It's an idée fixe and one of the things you care about a great deal, obviously.
Well, I honestly don't understand the vehemence on the part of people who enjoy guns. Their vehemence against, vehement opposition to handgun controls. Nobody is saying you've got to. Anybody's going to do away with hunting rifles or target rifles or gun clubs and things like that. But I think it's reasonable in a country with over 200 million people. To say that we should not make it easy or even possible for anybody, just about anybody, to own a death-dealing weapon they can conceal in their pocket. It serves no function other than to shoot somebody. You know, I guess out west, some ranchers will tell us that they need a six-shooter to kill snakes. But that is really a very specialized use of handguns. And so whenever I see a case like this, I make a point of writing about it.
What are three or four other things? Just generate a list for me that madly persist, though we could easily do something about it. What are three or four other things in the nation that get your goat as much as the abuse of handguns does?
Baldness. I think that's the main problem in our society is baldness among middle-aged men.
Yeah.
Causes more mental depression. If they could find a cure for baldness, I think we'd have a much happier nation. You wouldn't see guys combing their hair, parting it at the ear in order to get their sideburn up over the top of their head. And that always leads to other foolishness. Guys who do that will then go out and buy leisure suits and white Corfam shoes. And guy gets to that point, the next thing is going to be he's going to leave his wife and get an apartment on the lakefront and start going to disco joints and things like that, and he's a lost soul.
And he's going to get himself a little sports car.
A sports car, and make a nuisance of himself.
And open his shirt down to about the fourth button.
Yeah, right. He's going to start hanging out on Rush Street. And, so I think if we cure baldness, you'll be much happier nation.
I think you've got a great cause there. I am about 10 minutes late for a batch of commercials. We've got to take care of those, and it is time for anyone who wants to join us to give us a ring, because we'll be on to the phones in just a few minutes. And a few quick matters of business, and we're going to be on to the phones shortly after that. The first matter of business is the name of the station. We are WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. We are now putting together the mailing that will be going out at the end of this month the schedule for the programs for the month of September. And if you've been listening lately, you know that we've gone to a new system. We're now sending those out on the through a yearly subscription. You can get the monthly listings every month if you subscribe for a full year. That's the only way to do it. And it's a bargain because it only costs you $5, which doesn't quite cover the costs of the station. $5 sent to us at WGN, 2501 Bradley Place, Chicago, 60618, and we'll know what you're sending it for. Just address it to Extension 720, make the check out to WGN Radio, send it to us at 2501 Bradley Place, Chicago, 60618. We'll put you on the computerized list, and you will get your first issue, if you haven't yet subscribed, for September and on through August of next year. We're going to stop just quickly to take care of a leftover message and then right onto the phones, the number 591-7200.
Now back to Extension 720 and Milt Rosenberg.
And right on to the telephones for the many friends and perhaps even some who aren't friends of Mike Royko. 591-7200 is the number. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hey, hello.
Yes, sir.
Well, Mike doesn't have anything but friends. And Milt, you're a pleasure to Chicago. I like to say one thing. If I ever have a dream about being a liberal in Chicago the day after Reagan's election, I don't know if I could ever express it as well as Mike did. And that article about being the last liberal in the city of Chicago had brought joy to a tremendous amount of people. I'd like to have a little bit of an insight at how you arrived at writing it.
It was a column I did the morning of the election, the morning after the election?
Yes.
I don't remember, because usually that column is written after the returns are in, and I probably would have written that at about, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I haven't got the faintest recollection of how I... That was about 1,000 columns ago, and I don't know.
When you ran all the way across the country and wound up, and there was Nancy Reagan, who replaced the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, I honestly don't recall how that column came about.
Everybody reads your column, but that one was very well said.
Okay.
And Milt, I listened to you last night about the opportunities that you had to leave Chicago, and I just hope that you keep on refusing them.
Oh, it's too late now. I'm planted here.
Good
Thank
night.
You very much for the call, sir.
Right out.
Good night.
Good night.
591-7200 is the number. A trite question. You've been asked it 1,000 times, but what the caller was just talking about brings it to mind, and I can't resist. How does it really work, the column, the writing of the column, and the discovery of the idea? Do you know just naturally when you read something on that day or there's some kind of public event, you know this is it, this is... the next column?
Yeah, sometimes the event sort of jumps out at you, and I say, well, you know, that's something I can write 1,000 words about. I've got something to say on that subject. Or somebody will, I'll hear about, get a tip on a story, something happened to somebody, and if it works out, I know it's a story. It's just an instinct I have, news judgment or story judgment. I think I know what makes an interesting column.
You are a damn good investigative journalist as well as a superb satirical commentator on the public scene. You've done, of course, you've done many such stories, and I always find the most fascinating. Often somebody calls you with something that is outrageous, but it's got to be checked out, and you do dig in and you turn up stuff that any investigative reporter would be proud of.
Yeah, well, before I was a columnist, I was a reporter for the paper. I worked on a lot of investigations. I worked on politics, government, all kinds of things. So I do a certain number of investigations. I have to be selective because I can't do the type of thing that is going to take hundreds of man hours of laborious digging for detail. Occasionally when I get a tip like that, I pass it on to the paper. I just don't have the facilities for it. I've got one assistant who does research for me. And so I do occasional pieces when there's something I can do without tying myself up for
weeks. What's the last thing you came upon that really stirred your sense of outrage and generated an angry column?
Well, gee, I don't know. once I've written it, the anger generally dissipates because I've got to start thinking about the next column. I try not to work angry. If you get too angry at day-to-day events, and how much anger are you going to have left when something really outrageous comes along? There are columnists who are in a lather every day. I don't understand that. If you're going to get mad at a broken traffic light, what's your reaction going to be when Watergate comes along? So I try not to sit there. I try not to work in an angry condition. I try not to write when I'm angry. It's much safer to be calm when you're doing your job. That way you don't say something you might regret later. And I don't think readers want to read outrage every day. I think if I went around in a terrible lather all the time, they'd get a little tired of it.
It's interesting. Castiglione, in his famous book, The Courtier, says, "Revenge is a dish best eaten cold." You're kind of saying outrage is an art best pursued with a certain amount of calm and coldness.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Back to the phones. 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hello. I'm a student at Loyola University, a journalism student. And before I state my question, I would just like to tell you, Mr. Roykel, how greatly I admire you and your work.
Thank you.
And a lot of students, I work on the student newspaper, they also share my admiration for your work and yourself. My question is, what advice can an experienced journalist like yourself give to the many aspiring journalists of today? And maybe if I could sneak one more in, what is your philosophy in life?
Well,
handle the easier one first. What's your philosophy in life?
I don't have any particular philosophy in life. If you give me, I'll come up with one by tomorrow if you give me time. As far as advice to young journalists, my hard-eyed advice would be become a CPA. Because journalism has unfortunately in the last decade or so become a glamour field. The journalism schools have been just flooded with students, and they're graduating them, and there aren't enough jobs in journalism to accommodate them. At the same time, there are fewer and fewer daily newspapers, so you got more people after fewer jobs. But kids see Dan Rather making a zillion dollars a year on television, and they see
and getting kidnapped by Chicago cab drivers.
Yeah, Woodward and Bernstein being played by Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, and my, that's exciting. I wish they would do a few movies like that about accountants and dentists, and maybe get students going into that line of work. But my advice, if you are going to persist in going into this field, is to study something besides journalism. Economics is a good idea, political science. And then get as much practical experience you can while you're in school, working on the school paper.
I'm going to start from the bottom up.
Yeah,
City
and
News
then
Bureau.
Take what?
That's my...
The City News Bureau?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's a good route. The City News Bureau is a sort of a citywide wire service for the readers, for the listeners who don't know what it is. It's a good place to get nuts and bolts experience in reporting and basic news writing. And then from there, if you're serious about the business, you will then take whatever job you can. You'll go to some small town if you can and work there, and then take a job with a slightly larger newspaper if you can, and maybe if you're very lucky, you'll wind up on one of the bigger daily papers. But it's a crap game. A lot of luck is involved, being in the right place at the right time. Other than that, unless your father leaves you a newspaper, there's no way to today for a young person to land a job on a major paper without getting a background on smaller papers.
Where did you go to school, Mike, and what did you do there?
I have what is called a checkered academic background. I dropped out of high school as soon as I was old enough to quit. and went to work and knocked around, and then I went back and finished high school, and I started college, city colleges, and the Korean War came along, so I went in the service, and then when I got out of the service, I was planning on becoming a lawyer, but while I was in the service, brief period near the end of my enlistment, I worked on a military newspaper. I wound up as editor of a military paper by, you know, where the military is. I had absolutely no experience, and actually they made me the editor of the paper. So I decided to give journalism a try for a few months, see if I liked it. And if I didn't like it, then I was going to go become a lawyer. So I liked it, and I stayed in it, and I worked for a weekly paper and a couple weekly papers in the City News Bureau, and I wound up at the Daily News.
How long ago did you start at the Daily News?
1959, so it's, what, 23 years
ago. And the column began when, in the news?
1964. January 1st, I think. Why they keep celebrating on that date. Everybody goes out and gets drunk and blows horns.
Do you ever figure out how many columns you've run, written and had run in your time?
I've got a wristwatch calculator. I could figure it up, but I think it's something like 5,000, and that's at about 1,000 words, a kind of 5 million words.
That's a fair body of work, and a wonderful achievement if one takes the quality of the average column. Do you know when you've done a bad column?
Sure. Well, that's a funny thing. I've done columns that I've said, well, this is about as good as I can do on this subject, and I'm not going to make it any better by sitting here, so I'm going home. But I've been unhappy with the column, and the next thing I know, the phones are ringing, and people are saying, what a terrific column. I'm getting mad. I don't know. Sometimes I think I've done a good one, and nobody mentions it. I don't know.
You never know for sure. Let me thank our nice young caller, and we'll move on to another in just a moment. You never know for sure. I do a program sometimes that I think is just lousy. Lousy because of the way I handled it. And then we get a lot of complimentary calls and letters, and it's totally confounding. I guess a man is not the best judge of his own work, in a way.
No.
Here is that next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Mike, I read that column about a week ago on the incident of the William Tell thing down in Florida. It's one of the two or three columns that you write every week, it seems like, on gun control. It's getting a little tedious on that subject. But I just wondered, I was quite surprised to hear you say a few minutes ago that you had no quarrel with people that owned rifles or shotguns to be used in hunting. Now, I have no doubt that this man down there that shot the beer can off his buddy's head with a handgun also had a hunting rifle. And I'm just wondering if this same incident had taken place using a hunting rifle instead, if you'd have poured out as much venom toward the rifle owners in this country as you do to handgun owners, or whether you would have come out straightforwardly and put the blame squarely where it belonged, and that is on the overconsumption of alcohol rather on the possession of guns.
Well, first of all, I don't write two or three columns a week on the subject of gun control. That was probably the first column I had written in two or three months on the subject of gun control. I've probably done this year, a half a dozen columns on gun control. So you have a very, very sensitive. Obviously, you're a gun owner, and so one column a year would probably prove tedious to you.
That would tick me off right there.
Yeah, one a year. So let's not put the blame on me for doing it too often. Let's admit that you're very sensitive to the subject at any time. I don't think I would have written about it the same if it was a rifle or a bow and arrow, or if he was using throwing knives, or if they were swinging at each other with baseball bats. I was writing about handguns.
You had a column about a week ago on the, or 2 weeks ago on the incident out in Wyoming, I believe, where they shot a tent with a high-powered rifle.
Yeah, well, that was a pretty preposterous case. It was rifles rather than handguns, but it was such a remarkably horrifying case to me that I decided to write about
it. That's the one where they killed the young lady in the tent?
Yeah, they said that apparently they were being truthful. They were out hunting for bear, and they thought they saw a bear, so they shot up the bear, and it turned out to be a tent.
Well, you say that I am sensitive, and that's probably true, as most gun owners are, because of the publicity that we've gotten the last five or 10 years from these liberal newspapers, but I also am sensitive because as a gun owner, I'm a responsible gun owner. I don't get drunk and go out and put a tin can on my buddy's head. Of course, I don't get drunk and go out and drive my car either. I don't go out and get drunk and run my boat around a lake. And I should think that the blame in this instance should be laid directly where it was, and that's on the incidents of drinking. If the same man had walked drunk down the white line of a two-lane highway and played chicken and got run over, you wouldn't have did some kind of a satire on bringing back prohibition or banning use of automobiles. And I think it's a little unfair on our side that the whole weight of this goes on the gun owner, rather on the incidents where people do crazy things when they're intoxicated.
Well, why don't you strive to get liquor banned, and I'll strive to get handguns banned.
Well, I think that's a good idea, since we had such a remarkable success with it back in the Roaring Twenties with prohibition.
Okay, sir. We'll consider it a fair exchange, and I thank you for the call. And we'll pause briefly for a quick message and then right back to more calls on 591-7200.
And now back to Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720.
Thank you, Doug James. And right back to Mike Royko and to your calls for him. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Mr. Royko.
Yeah.
I also have enjoyed your writing for a number of years. There seem to be several individuals and groups that you write about quite often. Alderman in Chicago, John Madigan.
No, I haven't mentioned John Madigan's name in my column, and, oh, God, I don't remember who asked. I used to write about John Madigan years ago, but I don't think I mentioned him in a long time.
Another person that seems to crop up is Jesse Jackson.
Once in a while, when...
And I wonder if you've had any second thoughts about his position on the boycott of Chicago Fest. It seemed to me that your writing was rather simplistic and that there are reasons for black people to unite in this city against some of the political acts that are taking place against them. And although Chicago Fest may not be the best issue, it had the benefit of bringing black people together. And it seemed to me that your position was basically give them music and let's not say that this is political.
Well, Chicago Fest was not an issue. The Chicago Housing Authority Board was the issue. Chicago Fest was something that they, Jesse Jackson and others decided to use to dramatize their objections to Jane Byrne's appointments to the Chicago Housing Authority.
Is there anything wrong
so,
with that?
Pardon?
Is there anything wrong with that?
No. Jesse Jackson can lead boycotts against anything he wants to. My point was that I didn't think... the boycott would be would achieve its aim, and that would be to damage the whole concept of Chicago Fest, to hold attendance dramatically down. It didn't. I pointed out early in when this thing started that the result would probably be to. If anything, increase white attendance, especially people out in suburbs. As soon as they discovered blacks weren't going to be there, they might come out in greater numbers. I don't know that anybody's analyzed the attendance to see whether or not that was true. It was not an event that blacks have supported in great numbers in the past, so I don't see the advantage of boycotting something that you haven't made use of particularly. I just thought it was traditionally those who have led boycotts, those who have used different means of grassroots protest, have always had a specific goal in mind, and I didn't see what Jesse Jackson's specific goal was. It's easy to talk about mobilizing blacks on a political issue. The fact is, Jesse's been around town for a long time. The great weakness in mobilizing blacks politically is that there aren't enough blacks registered to vote to have the impact that their population numbers would indicate that they should have. And so anytime you talk about mobilizing blacks, you're talking about getting blacks to register to vote. Right now, Richie Daley's 11th Ward organization can produce 2.5 times as many votes in an election as the all-black 24th Ward can. And the 24th Ward has got as large a population, but they are not registered to vote. And I've heard Jackson do a lot of grandstanding about a lack of sensitivity on the part of the political people to black aspirations. Well, you can talk that kind of jargon all you want. What counts and what pays off is whether or not people are registered to vote. And I'm not impressed with boycotts of Chicago Fest. I'm impressed with numbers in the, on the polling sheets.
Okay. Sir, with that, I've got to move on. I thank you for an interesting question. 591-7200 is where you reach us, and here is the next caller. Hello.
Hello, it's Dr. Rosenberg.
Yes, sir.
Good evening. Good evening, Mr. Royko.
Hello.
Hope you're enjoying your vacation.
I am.
We've heard so much this evening about, you know, some of the harder sides of your columns, but three of them really stuck in my mind the last several years. After Prince Charles and Lady Diana got married, your column, What to Expect Out of Married Life, Wasn't All Glory, really meant quite a bit to myself and some friends of mine, and a lady in particular. And after your wife passed away a few years back, the column on the cottage up in Lake, up in Wisconsin, wherever it was, and it just showed to me such a different side of you, a sensitivity that I had not seen there before, and it really amazed me. I was very, very glad for that side of you, that you could express it that way. I think a lot of other people felt the same way about it.
No, I'm glad you liked it.
Like so many other people, we do enjoy your work, and glad to see you. You know, you're still here. One question interested me. When the Times folded, I know it was part of the
News.
The News, mm-hmm. Yeah. It was part of the Field organization. Would you have ever considered going over to the Tribune?
If I had not been happy with the Field organization, mm-hmm. I would have gone to the Tribune. The Tribune asked me to come there, but I had no reason to go to the Tribune.
Yeah, it seems so many years in the past, the columns have switched back and forth between the papers. And just one more, if I might say a quick one. Do you have a middle name?
No.
Okay, thanks for that. Enjoy your work, Doc.
Okay.
Thank you for the call, sir. Wasn't the Washington Post after you for a long time?
Yeah, the Post and the Star were both, Washington were both asking me to come there.
You gave that some serious thought, didn't you?
Yeah, well, at the time when the Post and the Star offered me a job, and when Ben Bradley heard that I was thinking of going to the Star, then he asked me to come to the Washington Post. But my family didn't want to go to Washington. My wife didn't want to go to Washington. My kids didn't want to go to Washington. And I couldn't see disrupting my family for essentially to do what I was doing in Chicago. It would have given me a more influential audience. When you're writing in Washington, you're read by everybody in government. But that would have been more of an ego thing. So I just couldn't justify my getting a little more glory while disrupting everybody else's life.
You're so associated with Chicago. That must be very comfortable. Yet I wonder if you are not sometimes tempted, as you look towards your future, to sometimes make the change. Even Nelson Algren left Chicago and went, of all places, to Hackensack, New Jersey, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I've thought about Washington. Washington, being a journalist in Washington, being a columnist in Washington, has kind of a narcotic effect. It's really an addiction, because if you're a news junkie, there's no place in the world like Washington. There are thousands of journalists in the town. Everybody is interested in politics. Everybody's interested in government. They think every day you watch the network news, and there's a certain frantic quality every day, as if every day this is really the biggest thing that could possibly happen. The whole country is going along at a certain level pace, concerning themselves with more fundamental problems in life, and they don't think that way. So when you get in Washington, I mean, the conversations you'll hear on elevators in Washington is incredible. You know, in Chicago, you get on an elevator and you hear somebody say, how was bowling league last night? Oh, fine, we got a pizza afterwards, and I got a flat tire on my car. In Washington, you'll hear someone come on and say, well, he's a new Federalist. Yes, but it took a long time before he evolved into that position. I was riding an elevator with in a government building with a friend of mine who works for a politician in Washington, and he's a former Chicagoan, and we got on the elevator, and he said, well, we got the confession out of her. And I looked at him. I didn't know what he was talking about, but I nodded. He said those electronic devices really worked. Did you see her jump when we switched on the juice? And the elevator was crowded, and people were kind of looking out the corner of their eye. And I said, yeah, she really jumped. And he said, well, that's another one for our side, and the hell with the Ruskies. And they kind of looked at each other, everyone in the elevator looking at each other knowingly. They thought we were some sort of CIA guys who'd been torturing someone. And no one turned and stared at us. I guess it seemed like a normal conversation in Washington.
Well, you have so much fun with Chicago's aldermen. Just think what fun you could have puncturing the hot air balloons that are constantly in the air in Washington.
Yeah, well, that's the reason why from time to time think about going there. Yeah. It's really fun, except, you know, do we need another Washington columnist? I don't know.
Well, it would be an irreparable loss for Chicago. I don't think Chicago could sustain your absence.
No, we lost Bushman, and we survived that. We could survive.
You classed yourself with Bushman. Well, sure. he had more hair, you know. We'll name the station. It's still WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. A quick pause, and then right back for more calls.
And now back to Extension 720 and Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Doug. We're talking tonight with Mike Royko, and your opportunity to talk with him is available on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, Dr. Rosenberg?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, first of all, I would like to tell you that I respect and value your opinion very much. I really can't tell you how much. And as I've been listening to you commend and applaud at length Mr. Royko's work, I felt compelled to make this comment. I remember a column in which Mr. Royko wrote that President Reagan is the most stupid president we ever had. Now, my feelings are, regardless of one's opinion about the president, it's really unprofessional to write something like that in a column read by millions of people. I personally feel that the office of the presidency in our country commands respect. And my feelings are also that such a statement is an emotional one, and it's irresponsible. And I would like to, as I said, I want to just emphasize that I respect your opinion, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about that before you would let Mr. Royko defend that.
Well, I respect Mike Royko's opinion, and I deeply admire his art, and I believe in straight, strong utterance with regard to important issues. I may or may not agree that Ronald Reagan is the stupidest president we've ever had, but it's interesting to me that Mike thinks so, and I'd like to hear right now why he thinks so.
Well, I spent a number of years paying attention to things Ronald Reagan said, and not so much how he said them, because he is wonderful in the way he says things. But in listening to the things he said for many, many years, going back to the 60s when he first made his aspirations clear, and the more I listened to what he said, the more I became convinced that this guy wasn't very bright. And I may have said this recently. I think it was maybe after he was elected or just before he was elected, but I said that 10, 12, 14 years ago. I just never thought Reagan was bright enough to handle this job, and I don't think he is today. Now, if that indicates any great disrespect on my part for the office of the president, I'm sorry, but there is a tradition in this country of open criticism and questioning of people in public office. He is a politician. He's a man who sought political office, and I don't think I've said anything nearly as harsh about him as, say, back in the days of Colonel McCormick that they said about President Roosevelt or President Truman.
Or back in the 1860s, what much of the press said about Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, sure. I've probably been pretty subdued in what I said about Reagan compared to things that Republicans have said about Democratic presidents. So I don't know that I'm guilty of treason or bad judgment.
Could I just say that I feel that we should have an absolute standard, and we shouldn't point to some other papers and say they wrote this and they wrote that. I feel that you should have your own personal standard, and the way you just explained it to me now is a lot different from what you wrote in your column. You just made that emotional statement. He's the most stupid president we ever had. I hope you understand.
No,
what
I don't
I'm
think I
say.
Said.
I'm not trying to be disrespectful.
I don't
to
think
you.
I said he was the most stupid president. I may have said he was the dumbest, I think he probably is. And since that's what I think, I don't see what you're. I don't even know what you mean by an absolute standard. I do have a standard, and if I think a politician is dumb, I say I think he's dumb.
I think that handles it. We all agree that we shall let a thousand flowers bloom, and any columnist who thinks he's the smartest president we've ever had is free to say so.
Or if they want to say I'm the dumbest columnist they ever read,
they're free to say that too. Here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to compliment Mr. Royko on his column that he wrote after John Belushi's death. I was so impressed. I've always enjoyed his columns and his political columns, which leads me to my question. Are you looking forward to the campaign for mayor that's coming up?
I always look forward to political campaigns. I'm too old, really, to go to the circus anymore, and Riverview is gone, so I can't go out there and go in the crazy house.
Mm-hmm.
So the next best thing is a political campaign.
I remember when you were talking. I remember what the word in one of your column that referred to that Mayor Daley could bequeath this and that to his sons, but he couldn't give them the knuckles.
Mm-hmm. I faintly remember something like that.
Yes. I don't know. Oh, the other thing I wanted to ask is, your column is syndicated.
Yeah.
Do they make any choice in the difference between what goes out? For example, if you're writing about Joe Blow, the alderman.
Yeah.
How is that accepted in other cities?
Well, as I explained earlier, usually when out of five columns a week, they'll pick the person who is in charge of the selection of columns for the Wire. We'll pick the ones that are least local and most general, and we'll send three of those out.
Okay, and facetiously, I thought you were on vacation. What are you doing still in Chicago?
Well, I don't keep a very precise schedule book, and so when Milt asked me to be on his show, I said okay, and forgetting that I was going to take this week off.
Well, I'm glad that you did. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you for the call, ma'am.
Pardon?
I simply said thank you for the call.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Good night. And I'm really very grateful to you for coming down. You actually drove down from your summer place tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Are you really going to drive back tonight, too?
Sure.
It's beyond the normal call of duty. I'm really most pleased, and I owe you one. I don't know how I can repay it. 591-7200. You can ask. I know I can repay it. You can ask me to write a guest column for you.
No.
another bit of grandiosity on my part shot to hell. But we'll get back to the telephones. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask Royko what the quid pro quo is in his relationship with Walter Jacobson.
A quid pro quo?
Right.
I don't. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think you're giving Jacobson unnecessary publicity, and I wonder what he's doing for you.
Walter provides me with a certain amount of entertainment. I turn on my television set and watch Walter bounce up and down in a great lather over a pothole or something, and I find it delightful. And so every so often I can't suppress it. I have to write some small thing about Walter, and I don't know that I'm giving him that much publicity.
Well, the payoff is you give him publicity, says the caller, and he gives you amusement.
Yeah. That's the only quid pro quo there is, because...
that's a fair enough exchange.
Yeah.
What about that?
He gives me viewing pleasure. He's a very entertaining fellow. I don't think he means to be, but I find him such.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Is it a bit of a put-on, or...
Oh, I like Walter.
You like him personally.
You're confessing
that to the world.
Yeah, I work with Walter. We were both fairly young reporters.
And Walter likes you, I trust.
I'm not a young reporter anymore, but Walter still looks like a young reporter.
He does. He will forever. 591-7200 is our number, and we go now to this call. Good evening. You're on the air. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Mike.
Yes.
This is an honor to talk with you, believe me.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you.
The world is in such a serious mood, and your humor makes something living more palatable, I'll tell you that. Your humor is elegant. I'm wondering if you know anything about John Justin Smith. I'm sure you do. And his history of Chicago. It's a book called Chicago, A Portrait. Didn't John Justin Smith work for the Daily News going way back?
Yeah, well, way, way back. John started the Daily News as a copy boy.
Really?
And, but I'm not sure. When was this book published?
In 1931.
That was his uncle.
A friend of mine has a copy of it.
John Justin Smith did not write that. It would have been Henry Justin Smith.
Who was the editor of the Daily News, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was the. This was John's uncle, Henry Justin Smith, who was the editor of the paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering if there was any source that you might know about where I could get a copy of it. It's one of the books that I would like to add to my library. It's a very valuable history of Chicago.
You might call John at the Sun-Times, and he might have some suggestions.
Okay. Might I ask one question, please?
Yeah.
How did you feel about the closing down of the Chicago Daily News? It was a heartbreak for me and many in my family, and I was just wondering how you all felt, you who worked there.
Well, I wrote a couple columns the last 2 days it published.
I was living in Dallas at the time.
And, obviously, you work on a newspaper. I had worked on that paper for 19 years or 20 years, and that's where I started. They're the ones who gave me a job when others wouldn't give me a job, and they gave me my column. So obviously, I was, at the time the paper folded, I was associate editor of the paper, and it was a very wrenching experience.
Well, let me say to you, please, keep up that elegant humor. Don't let anybody bash it down.
Okay.
Because without it, life wouldn't be nearly as sweet daily.
Thank you.
And thank you, and God bless.
Thank you for the call, ma'am. And here is the next. Good evening.
Hello, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of my favorite books is the one you wrote about Mayor Daley Boss.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you have any plans to do a similar one about Mayor Byrne.
Maybe sometime down the line. But right now, I'd have a hard time writing a book about her. She's 3 years is not a long time in an office. And I don't know that there's enough there, really, in terms of material to do a political study. At the time I wrote Boss, Daley had been mayor for, about 15 years, and he had pretty much established his public record. So maybe someday, but not in the near future, no.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the call, sir. 591-7200 is the number. There is now a line open. If you've been trying to get through, now's the time to grab for it if you are so moved. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Mike, you have been an observer on the Chicago scene now for 20-some years. How would you compare Chicago today as when you began your career politically, socially, culturally as a city? Are we better? Are we worse? Are we the same? How would you describe us today? Is there hope for Chicago?
Sure. I don't think you can be without hope. There's a lot of reasons to be hopeful. But I'd say that there appears to me to be a great deal less blatant corruption in the city today than there was when I started as a reporter. There was almost a scandal a week in Chicago then. There were exposés going on constantly. There was you take any government body and you can recall the sanitary district scandal, the traffic court scandal, this one scandal after another. And we don't have that now. Either the politicians are getting more clever, which I really doubt, or we aren't we are pursuing them as vigorously. But I really think that that and I would have to give considerable credit to Jim Thompson when he was U.S. Attorney. He just he nailed so many machine piles for one form of mischief or another that I think they really started getting worried. And when guys like Tom Keene wind up in a federal pokey, then the next guy is going to the next pinky ring guy is going to think a little bit about the kind of stunts he's going to pull with public money. So I think that. You know, if we had time, I could get specific about different areas of city government. But I do think it is less blatantly corrupt than it was. And as far as the tone of life in Chicago, I don't know. We're a city that ranges from the affluence of the Gold Coast to the despair of terrible slum areas. So. It's hard to judge what the quality of life is. There have always, when I was a kid, there were some pretty miserable. There were far more miserable parts of the city than there are today. I think the when you talk about slums and compare them to 20 years ago, 30, 40 years ago with today, no, I don't think that people live anywhere near as badly at the bottom level as they did then. There's talk of police. Constant talk of police brutality. It exists in this city, but when I was a police reporter, I was invited by policemen to beat on a prisoner once when because their arms were tired, and they asked me if I'd mind going and giving them a few swats in the head to relieve them. Brutality was so common then that the veteran police reporters thought it was part of. They didn't even pay attention to it. So. I don't know. There's so life in the big cities has never been all that pleasant for the majority of people. Big cities have always been crowded, tough to live in, it's tough to live in now.
Ma'am, we have to dash along. I fear. Thank you for an interesting question.
Thank you very much.
Good night. And a few quick words from Duck James, and then back. To more calls on 591-7200.
Once again, here's Milt.
Thank you, Doug. And once again, here's a caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Oh, Milt Rosenberg?
Yes, sir.
This is Robert C. Hayden, Jr.
All right.
Hear your program. Mike Rocco, are you still a Cub fan? And how do you like writing them columns that you did about the Cubs?
Well, I always like writing columns about the Cubs. I am still a Cub fan, of course. There was a brief period where I dropped off to protest the... lazy nature and the petty whining of a bunch of ball players they had, but they've got rid of those ball players, and now they've got some inept but very sincere athletes.
Sincerity is really what counts, not winning.
And sure, I'm a Cub fan.
How about the White Sox?
Well, I'm, it pleases me that the Sox are doing as well as they are because they've got, if for no other reason, they've got a couple of nice Chicago boys on the team, Kevin Hickey. Used to play softball occasionally with Kevin, and Greg Luzinski, a splendid slugger from the northwest suburbs. So, I hope the Sox win the World Series.
And Milt?
Yes, sir.
About the final scores coming in, Green Bay's beaten Cincinnati 41-27.
That's the most exciting thing I've heard tonight.
They had a really exciting ball game at Connie Stadium tonight. I'm watching on Channel 7.
Thank you for the bulletin, sir.
Okay.
Probably also darning his socks while watching television and listening to this program. One more quick call, and here it is. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, are you there? Hello? Apparently not. Well, listen, that leaves me 4 whole minutes before we come to the end of the time. I've been working you very hard, and the callers have. Just last night, for the first time since I've been doing this program, which is 10 years, we reversed roles. Jim Lockman came in to host the program, and I was the solo guest. It was a commemoration of my having done it for 10 years, and I found it a very unaccustomed and strange situation. And it gave me sort of a new insight into what the solo guest must feel. There's a lot of pressure, especially when you're asked about yourself, and a kind of a conflict as to how much of yourself you want to let out and how much you want to reserve. So again, I'm turning a touch intrusive, and you may resist this. It's not heavy stuff, but it's just curiosity. How you live. I wonder who your friends are. I wonder how you organize your life apart from the work about which we've talked so much.
Well, I live with my two sons. One of them is a graduate student in psychology.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's going to a school. He's going to get his PhD and become a clinical psychologist. And the other one is out of school, and he's got a job, and I won't invade his privacy by being any more specific than that. My friends are a variety of people, old friends, people I work with, people from I have friends in politics. I have friends in all walks of life. I don't know. It'd be hard for me to categorize my friends.
What's your favorite restaurant in Chicago?
If I had to eat in one place, I don't know. It depends on what I'm.
It wouldn't really be Billy Goat's.
No, good God, no. a lot of good restaurants.
I'm always fascinated by good writing and by the people who do the good writing, and I always wonder what they read and what influenced them and sort of shaped the style, shaped the, what the literary boys call the sensibility. What's important to you in
terms
reading?
Of what I read? Yeah. I don't remember when I have last read anything in fiction. I don't know who's writing good novels or bad novels. I just don't have time. I read a lot of magazines that deal more with, you know, magazines like The Nation and Harper's and magazines like that. And I read a lot of newspapers, and magazines and newspapers are basically my reading. And occasionally books on politics, books on different issues that interest me.
The new collection of your columns that's coming out, when did you say it's going to be published?
October sometime.
And who is the publisher on that one?
Dutton, the same people who did Boss, my daily book, and my later collection.
So we should be seeing that in October.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly it'll be all over Chicago.
I hope so.
And all over the country.
Yeah, it's going to be... They're hoping it will sell another...
The public relations person who's handling that book called me. She's an old friend a week or two ago and asked whether we would have you on that occasion. And I said, of course. Are you game for that again?
Sure.
As little as 3 months from now?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Doesn't kill your ratings. I'll come back.
It's evident from the heavy volume of phone calls we've had tonight that... Your being here does not affect
our
ratings.
There was no one on the line the last time.
Oh, well. Probably stunned by whatever your prior answer had been. We're out of time. Truly, it's been a great pleasure having you here again. Mike Royko has been our guest. And if you want more of Mike Royko, you know when to find him. When's the vacation over?
Next week sometime.
So the column will be back again next week, as we will be next Tuesday night. Thanks to all for listening.